Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Greetings, everyone. Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Daniel Paris. I'm delighted to have as my guest today, Edward Chancellor. He is an author, a historian, and an investment strategist, and he's the author most recently of The Price of Time, The Real Story of Interest. It's out just now from Atlantic Monthly Press. Edward, thank you so much for agreeing to be on the show.
Pleased to be with you.
Your timing is impeccable. I was wondering if you could take me to a couple horse races and bet on some ponies. You've written a book on the implications of what happens when interest rates go perhaps pear-shaped, shall we say, or move sharply in one direction or another. You wrote the book, I imagine, over the last several years. And then the pub date is August 16th, almost perfectly timed for a sharp reversal in interest rates, particularly in the last few days in England. Gilts have skyrocketed. We're taping this on the 29th of September. Tell me about your sense of timing, and are there any investments that I can make with you that would allow me to take advantage of what appears to be a almost perfect sense of multi-decade timing?
Well, Daniel, you're probably aware how long it takes to get a book out. So I'd finished this book really by April of last year, and it was in another 14 months or so before it hit the bookstores. And so, and I probably could have finished the book, you know, a couple of years earlier if I'd been any quicker. So I think the timing is a matter of luck. We've had this very long period of ultra-low interest rates, which is the subject of the second half of the book, which we'll obviously discuss later. And that had been going on for for a very long period of time. And it was unclear to me, and I think to most market participants, when it would finally come to an end.
People make their own good luck, so I congratulate you all the same. Let's take a kind of break the book down, because I think it's wonderfully written, by the way, and easily for people who might not naturally move towards a book on interest rates, but are interested in what's going on in the world economy or their own economy. This is actually a great introduction, so I highly recommend it. But I would structure the book in three different ways, because it operates on many levels. The first is explanation, the second is history, and the third is some of the arguments that you're really kind of making. But you do a very good job early on the book in explaining interest rates, and it turns out that it's been a topic that's been debated for centuries, not just by economists, but by philosophers, by theologians, by business people. And I think you have some great examples of people mulling this over for centuries. Do you want to provide some kind of highlights on how the definition of interest, how it works in an economic sense and in a practical sense, and why it's been such a, in many ways, a controversial issue for centuries?
Yeah, Millennia, not centuries. Well, interest has been around for five millennia. We can find its earliest origins, recorded origins, in ancient Mesopotamia, and for most of that period, it's been the subject of a great deal of strife or criticism, and then intellectual disagreement. And the criticism of interest, which one can find clearly articulated by the Greek philosopher Aristotle, was that interest is exploitative because the lender is demanding back more than he's given in the loan. So the interest being the increment on the loan. And my argument is that Aristotle got it wrong. And Aristotle's, you mentioned theologians, Aristotle's ideas were taken up by Catholic theologians or scholars, scholastics in the Middle Ages, most notably Thomas Aquinas. And they stuck to the idea of, you know, the medieval theologians were obsessed about, you know, what, you know, about justice, what we would now call social justice, and unfair prices. And they thought that interest was an unfair price, an unfair charge, exploitation again. But one of the medieval scholars, Thomas of Cobham, an English scholar, made an interesting comment. He said that the lender was a seller of time because the loan takes place over a period of time. And then Thomas of Cobham says, well, this is still wrong because time belongs to God. Well, that may be acceptable if you have a sort of entirely theological view of society. But when you move into a secular society from, you know, the Renaissance onwards, then of course we start seeing time as man's own possession or man's most precious possession. And as you move into a capitalist society, you get this famous comment, so much repeated by Ben Franklin, that time is money. And my argument in the book is that not only is interest an omnipresent phenomenon, in other words, what I call the price of time, is just a function of human existence because human beings are impatient and we need to, you know, we need to put a different value on something, on having something today from having it tomorrow or even, you know, in 10 years' time. There's a difference in values across time. But once you get into a complex capitalist or market economy, then there are all these transactions taking place across time, namely, say, for instance, investment, and what level of investment you see, what return do you seek on your investment? Well, that's affected by the hurdle rate or what business people call the payback period, which has an embedded interest in it. Now, the valuation, whether of stocks or equities or real estate, you can't have valuation without a discount or interest rate. In an economy where people borrow, lend and borrow, they're shifting their consumption across periods of time. And if you remember one point in the book, I say, if you think about these intertemporal transactions as taking place across a river, a bridge joining the present to the future, then interest is really the toll on the bridge that allows people to coordinate their activities between the present and the future. I might, you know, as I'm getting on a bit in life, you know, not be seeking to borrow to, you know, to boost my consumption today. But you know, when I was in my early 20s at college, I was borrowing because, you know, I thought at some stage I'd get a job and be able to pay back the loan. So you see all these activities, they're all interlinked. And at some level, they have to be coordinated. And the interest rate coordinates the activities across time. There's a certain, towards the end of the book, I cite Warren Buffett saying that interest is to valuation what gravity is to nature. And what he's saying there is really that, you know, that all valuations will be sort of affected by the interest rate. But you can actually take Buffett's point even more generally and say that interest is like gravity for human society. It's something that even if you don't see it, even if you're engaged in activity where it's not obvious. For instance, you know, believe it or not, even if you buy a car for cash, because it's a durable asset, there will be, and it will be giving you its use over a number of years. That use over a number of years has within it an embedded interest rate or discount rate. So I'm saying that the main argument of the book is that interest is everywhere, and it is the essence, in particular, of a capitalist system, but holds for all types of societies. And then when we get on later to what's been going on recently, I say a lot of the problems that I think we see today can be ascribed to abnormally low interest rates.
So in that definition, again, there are the philosophers, and that you do have some fascinating points from the religious side. But you do also cover several centuries of economists wrestling not only with the definition, but the implications of higher versus lower and meddling with interest rates. It is a central issue in finance. So what I really appreciate about The Price of Time is the integration both of the history and the economic debates. It's not a settled issue, and you do a very nice job covering that. And of course, there's just ample material over five millennium, and you do cite Will Getzman, who's been a guest on the show before, and has done a wonderful job with the first, call it, four and a half millennia, and you're then focusing on the last half millennium. But there the evidence.
Can I stop you there for a second?
Sure.
Because William Goetzman makes, I think, you know, I cite it perhaps more than once in the course of the book, a comment when he's writing about origins of finance in Mesopotamia, where he says the invention of interest is the most important invention in the history of finance because it allows people to transact across time. And I think that Goetzman, you know, completely gets it. And then, you know, a lot of other great economists, you know, Joseph Schumpeter, he says that interest is an essential phenomenon. Irving Fisher of Yale, perhaps, you know, some people consider him to be the greatest American economist of the 20th century. He says interest is an omnipresent phenomenon. And even Karl Marx, who tends to the view of the medieval scholars that interest is abusive and exploitative, he also says that he has a rather evocative phrase where he says that interest exists in the pores of production. And so you can see that I think every great economist, regardless of their sort of political inclination, has sooner or later come to the understanding that this was a vitally important subject.
Will has a great line, which basically you've just restated, which is, you know, finance is a time machine. And it's a great kind of image to describe what these tools do. Now, sometimes the time machine breaks down or puts us in the wrong spot, but it is indeed a time machine. Let's go over a couple of the instances where interest rates kind of went haywire and might have been misleading or causes of problems, basically speculative bubbles and rises and falls of societies and prosperity and collapses. You really narrated wonderfully the Bank of England, the Bank of France, the ups and downs of the 19th century. Walter Bagot. How do the English pronounce his last name? I'm sorry. I'm going to as a
Bagot.
So there, I as an American have just showed how American I am. I've been referencing him for decades, and I've never once pronounced his name correctly. Thank you, Bagot. Walter Bagot, the lender of the last resort for the Bank of England, and so forth. Some of your best episodes of where changes in the rates of interest and from your perspective, unnaturally low interest rates create all sorts of problems in past instances.
Yeah, I will. But before I do, I just want to, you know, preface my comments with an observation that 20 odd years ago, I wrote a history of financial speculation called Devil Take the Hindmost, which covers, you know, most of the, you know, the great speculative periods up to the millennium. And that book was largely influenced by the behavioral finance explanations of bubbles that have been popular in recent years. I mean, you think of sort of Robert Shiller of Yale and his book Irrational Exuberance, and Daniel Kahneman, who Nobel Prize winner, and wrote a very popular book called Thinking Fast and Slow. And Kahneman, is associated with this field of behavioral finance of people making cognitive errors. And so there is this view that speculative mania is largely to do with sort of irrational exuberance, to use Schiller's phrase. And in this book, I'm laying aside, as you can see, the cognitive or behavioral explanations for the bubble and focusing on the monetary aspects. And what I argue is that all the great bubbles from the Dutch tulip mania of the 1630s through to what was called the everything bubble, which is the bubble the bubbles that appeared over the last decade and reached their crescendo last year, that these have all occurred at periods of abnormally low interest rates or falling interest rates or extremely easy money. And that's true, as I say, from the 17th century onwards. The example that I cite at great length in a chapter of its own is that of John Law and the Mississippi bubble that occurred in France in 1719 and 1720. And the reason I examine that bubble or that speculative mania at length is that John Law, who was a Scotsman who came to France in the early 18th century, he had this idea of establishing a central bank and replacing gold with paper money. He established, as many of your listeners will know, a company that we call the Mississippi Company. Its actual name was the Compagnie des Indes. And that what Law did, having established his central bank, is he printed a lot of paper money, and he used most of the money from his central bank went actually to acquire shares in his company. And that company also took over the French national debt. And Law managed for a brief period to bring French interest rates down from 6 to 8% down to 2% or even less than 2%. And the valuation of his company, the Mississippi Company, over a brief period went up 20-fold until it was trading on an earnings yield, what we call an earnings yield, which is the dividend the dividend and the profits as a percentage of the share price. The dividend yield and earnings yield were 2%. So you can see, and John Law at the time said the value of the shares is justified by the low interest rates. And then what happened, having flooded the French economy with paper money, the money then spread out into the economy, created an inflation, and Law's scheme fell to pieces, and he actually had to flee the country in disgrace and lost his fortune. He estimated his fortune one stage to be the greatest fortune ever held by any individual in entire history, and it was gone in a flash. And why I think this is so instructive, as I say at the end of that chapter, is that the modern economists and central bankers actually use law as their model. They say, and actually William Gertzman in his book, in his History of Finance, also talks up law. And I thought, when I'm looking at that, I found slight cognitive dissonance between the praise given to law as an economist and as a sort of the first practitioner of what would now be called active monetary policy, and the complete disaster of his scheme. I think that when a currency is backed by a commodity, such a, or a precious metal such as gold, then the role of the, what was initially they were called national banks, like the Bank of England, the role of the Bank of England was just to ensure the convertibility of its paper notes into gold. And therefore the process of setting interest rates was automatic in the sense that if the Bank of England was sitting on a great pile of gold, had excess reserves, they would keep interest rates low. But when gold flowed out of the bank vaults, and in particular when it left the country, and that there was a danger that the bank wouldn't be able to convert its notes into gold on demand, then interest rates rose. So there was, an automatic market mechanism that determined the interest rates. Now, I'm not saying that was a perfect system, because in the 19th century you had very severe financial crises, really at 10-year intervals in Britain and America, roughly. And those were, very harsh to live through. Masses of bankruptcies, large periods of, unemployment. So in the 20th, over the course of the 20th century, we have moved to a paper currency system. Gold is no longer the backing of the currency. And over that period, then, the interest rate is essentially determined by the decisions of the central banks. And the incentive, I argue, has always been to keep interest rates low, to avoid, the pressures and convulsions of economic downturns and financial crises. And that that pays off in the short run, in that if you can deal with a financial crisis, you mentioned Walter Badgett, the British financial journalist economist, who had this idea that the role of the central bank should be as lender of last resort during a crisis. In other words, when the financial world is falling to pieces and bond yields are going up and so forth, then the central bank can come in and maintain calm. The danger, as I've tried to explain in the book, is that you can have too much of a good thing, and that, and here we're getting on to sort of more recent history, that after the financial crisis of 2007-2008, central banks, as you know, took interest, when the Federal Reserve took interest rates to close to zero, the Fed funds rate, and in Europe and Japan, interest rates were taken to negative. And as you remember, I say, citing Gertzman, if the invention of interest was the most significant event in financial history, the appearance of negative interest that had never been seen in five millennia must be considered at least the second most important innovation. And my argument is that we enjoyed certain benefit from bringing the financial crisis and what was called the Great Recession to an early end. But there were unforeseen and unacknowledged consequences from the lowest interest rates in history that sapped the financial system. Well, he's put the financial system into an extremely precarious position and sapped the dynamism from our economies.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Let's highlight that again. One of the terms of art that's used to describe ultra-low interest rates and its impact on investment and business decisions is financial repression. It sounds pretty gruesome, and in many ways it is. Do you want to provide a description of how financial repression has worked for the past 15 years? That's on one hand, punishing savers. And on the other hand, ultra-low rates have created bubble after bubble after bubble, which when they burst, it's very economically disruptive. And these two things are occurring at the same time. The virtuous people, the savers, are getting punished and the speculators are getting rewarded. It's not a good scene.
The term financial repression is a term coined by American economists to describe monetary practices in emerging market countries, which was keeping interest rates too low, below the level of inflation. So you had negative real interest rates. And in fact, Britain and America and much of Europe after the Second World War practiced this so-called financial repression, in that interest rates were kept below, inflation took off, and that eroded the real value of the government debts that were left over from the Second World War. And since the financial crisis, we have been in a period of, so to speak, financial repression, in that inflation, even when it was low and before it took off in the last year, was still at least on average a couple of percentage points above the deposit rates in banks. And I have an account with Citibank, and at the end of the year, you all have it, taxable income on deposits, sort of $5 if you're lucky, if you've kept a big deposit. And I think that lost American depositors around $500 billion a year in the immediate aftermath of the crisis, which is a considerable sum. So as you say, you penalize the savers, and I think in particular, as I argue that the less well off you are, the more of your financial resources are likely to be kept in cash. We all need really enough cash, to bide us over in the event of some unexpected, unpleasant event. So we all keep, precautionary cash, and frankly, the less well off you are, the more that precautionary cash is going to be a share of your total wealth. Whereas, if you're very well off, your likely to invest in the type, make the type of investments that did very well over the last decade. You probably have some exposure to private equity, which benefited from the very low interest rates, cheap borrowing costs to buy and lever up companies. You might well have some exposure to venture capital, buying into these so-called unicorn companies, these tech companies, unlisted tech companies with billion-dollar valuations and more. And the unicorns, the venture capital, benefited in a number of ways from the very low interest rate environment, partly because their profits were, if they exist at all, were in the very long distant future. So if you have very low interest rates, the present value of those profits is high. In other words, and also investors were just basically rolling the dice and they were looking for higher returns at a time of low rates. And then if you were in the equity market, then bonds, the equities did very well. And in particular, if you're quite well off, it's not abnormal to have your private wealth manager give you leveraged exposure to the S&P 500. I argue that the very low interest rates were one of the reasons why inequality appeared to be increasing inequitably.
Not Thomas Piketty's inequality, but a different inequality, because you do a special outtake to address Piketty and why his argument from about a decade ago is error filled, but that the financial repression has created social problems, but not exactly Piketty's.
Well, what one finds, going back to people arguing about interest over the millennia, is that the economists who are interested in inequality and make that their main source of study, they tend to take the Aristotelian view of interest being exploitative. Sort of in a way, nothing has much changed, or the Marxist view. And Piketty, if you remember, has this formula where he says that when the rate of growth rate of return, which he calls R, is lower than the rate of growth, then you will have higher than the rate of growth, then you will have rising inequality. And I argue the inverse of Piketty. I say, In economics, it's quite conventional to use the notation R for the rate of interest. I say when R, the rate of interest, is less than growth, as it was over the last decade, or has been for much of this century in the United States, then you will create asset price bubbles, financial booms, and the financial booms will benefit people working on Wall Street. Rising share prices will benefit the senior executives of listed companies, private equity firms, and so on and so forth. And therefore, you will have a rise in inequality. And I think you can see that quite clearly, both historically, periods of the 19th century when interest rates were falling. Think of the Gilded Age. Yeah? Every American knows about the Gilded Age of Vanderbilt and Jay Gould and Carnegie and Mellon and so forth. Now, the Gilded Age was a period of falling and low interest rates. And then in the 1920s, as I argue, although interest rates ostensibly were quite high, in both nominal and real terms, central bank rates were high in the 1920s. They were very low compared to the extraordinary rate of return, the most productive period in US economic history. So interest rates were low there. And then you got this great boom on Wall Street and a great rise in inequality, followed by a collapse in the Great Depression. And then, you've really seen the same phenomenon over the last actually 40 years. And I have a chart where I show taking the data from Emmanuel Saez, who's the a colleague of Thomas Piketty's, where he has well share of the top 1% of the population, and I show that it sort of tracks the return on the long bond yield, and the long bond yield, that return is derived in large part from the falling interest rates, and there's sort of almost a perfect match between the decline in interest rates and the accumulation of fast assets by a small section of population. And you forget about the 1%. I mean, the real story is in the 0.1% or the one in a thousand.
You choose to end the book with a subtitle, The Road to Serfdom Revisited, about how kind of pernicious this phenomenon is. And then a year or two later, interest rates stop going down. We've had spikes in interest rates. And what is your take? It's not in the book by definition, but you as an observer of the current market, gilds are spiking. There's the temporary liquidity crises in England right now. Interest rates have moved up sharply in the United States. The U.S. 10-year is at 4%. It's really a quite striking and rapid reversal of the always low interest rate environment. We've had the return of inflation for the first time in decades. Your thesis sort of played out, as I mentioned at the top of the show, but what is your take now that it has and how things are proceeding?
Well, the very low interest rates of the last decade built sort of worm their way into the assumptions of investors and bankers and policymakers. Now, let me cite, I think there's a good comment made by Seth Klarman, who's Boston hedge fund manager, really one of the most successful and intelligent investors in the United States. Now, at the end of 2020, Klarman wrote this in his annual report to his clients. The idea of persistently low rates has wormed its way into everything. Investor thinking, market forecasts, inflation expectations, valuation models, leverage ratios, debt ratings, affordability metrics, housing prices, and corporate behavior. Moreover, by truncating downside volatility, forestalling business failures, and postponing the day of reckoning, such policies have persuaded investors that risk has gone into hibernation or simply vanished. Now, that was the prevalent, that what Klarman's talking about was the prevalent assumptions that were holding until the beginning of this year. Inflation appeared last year, but we were told it was only going to be temporary and that it was a blip, something to do with, interruption of supply chains during the COVID pandemic. Then the markets woke up this year to the fact that it wasn't a blip, that inflation was more durable and that interest rates would have to rise to help contain inflation. So that all these assumptions that people had acted upon are beginning to turn out to prove false. And every financial crisis or bust really occurs when market participants realize that their key assumption was wrong. And think back to, in the dot-com bubble, there was this assumption that the internet was growing at, I don't know, sort of 100% every 2 months. That turned out to be an exaggerated phenomenon. Then it turned out that, a lot of companies like Enron and WorldCom had borrowed too much money. They went bust. In the early 2000s, the assumption was that that US house prices could never fall. And so all these mortgages were bundled together, if you remember, cut into tranches and acquired by banks. That assumption was false, and the global financial system started to topple. And then we had the Eurozone debt crisis. The assumption was all European bond yields would converge together, and there was no sovereign risk within the Eurozone. That assumption proved to be false, and you know, all hell broke loose. Now, I have to, you know, I don't like to say it, but if interest is an omnipresent phenomenon and is everywhere, and we have built a world on the assumption that interest rates would remain very, very low indefinitely, and have levered ourselves up and increased our the valuations of assets and so on and so forth, and thought that we were worth X when really we were probably worth half X, then you can see that the working out of the retreat from that false assumption and the moving to a different world is going to be a difficult one. And
so if the historian in you is saying, forgive me for summarizing your words, the historian in you is saying, I told you so, what is the investment strategist saying? I realize you have paying clients and we are not among them. So you don't have to give us the exact path to navigate this. But based on your review of the historical instances where these bubbles have burst in the past, you know, what other than preparing for higher risk rates and higher risk at a higher risk environment, is there a particular course of action that you would recommend the listeners and readers of your book take?
It's a difficult problem. I think, you know, problem of evading the consequences of this great wealth inflation is pretty much impossible. It's certainly impossible in aggregate for a society. I mean, I show a chart of U.S. household wealth. At the end of last year, roughly, you know, 2.5%, 2.5 times U.S. GDP above its long-term average. So I don't think there's any way in which society as a whole can protect itself from the normalization of valuations that will occur. I think that there are things you can do. What we've seen this year is that assets, in technical terms, in investment terms, we talk about duration, which is the sensitivity of an asset to a change in interest rate. And because, you know, very long-lived assets like equities or long-term bonds are very sensitive to duration, and we've seen that this year. You know, the global bond and stock markets are both in bear territory. You can mitigate that somewhat. For instance, you can buy what are called value stocks, you know, cheaper stocks, avoid the growth stocks that did very well in the last decade and buy the value stocks. And, you know, and there are, you know, I think there are some cheap equities out there. I think that the, you know, go back to the subject of financial repression. I think that financial repression will continue in some shape or form, even if interest rates are going to be volatile, that the authorities will keep interest, their policy rates below inflation. And I think the danger is that we've now moved into a period that, you know, might last several years in which inflation is quite high. And I think the way to deal with that is now you can get decent yields on American inflation protected bonds or TIPS. And, you know, gold, you know, the gold, if you're outside the US, gold has been reasonably good this year and not so good in the US because the dollar has been very strong. I think now from an American based investor, it's a good time because the dollar is so strong to be buying cheap equities outside the US in Japan or some of the emerging markets. Although, as you know, I have a sort of great caveat about China, which we haven't spoken about, because I argue that, you know, that China has had this great real estate bubble and investment boom and credit boom. And I do think that, that China is really a place where investors should steer clear for, you know,
I don't think we're going to have time for it, but I will mention to prospective readers, there is a long and very detailed chapter on China that is worth the detour and to make sure that readers do look at it. Edward Chancellor, thank you so much. Edward Chancellor is the author of the just published The Price of Time, The Real Story of Interest, a well-timed book for anyone who is puzzled and maybe concerned, as perhaps as they should be, about the rapid change in interest rates we've seen over the last couple months. This is an excellent back rounder as well as a tool to understand what is going on. Edward, thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Daniel.